From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is a special edition of On Point before a live audience at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government in Cambridge, Massachusetts. To our audience here in the hall and listeners around the country, welcome to On Point. Thank you. Thank you very much. We are talking about democracy here in this hall, kicking off a two-year series of programs on challenges to democracy that is being mounted by the Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation here at Harvard. Our theme in this hour goes to maybe the biggest area of challenge to American democracy today, democracy and inequality. You might think there's a big challenge to democracy in Washington's shutdown right now. Fair enough. But there's a context. The world's oldest constitutional democracy, the United States, has become one of the developed world's most unequal nations. What does that mean for how our democracy functions or doesn't function? This hour on Point, Democracy and Inequality. We are recording this show before a live audience at the JFK Junior Forum at the Harvard Kennedy School. We've invited questions from our audience here and from our listeners around the country, online, on Facebook, on Twitter, and they have poured in. Big questions about whether the fundamentals of democracy can be preserved in a country where the gulf between rich and poor is so wide, whether extreme inequality and democracy are fundamentally at odds, and if they are, how do we move forward? So we are loaded for bear here. Let's go. We've got three big thinkers on the issue with me here on the stage. Chrystia Freeland, celebrated journalist with the Financial Times, Thomson Reuters, and more, author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else, a longtime friend of On Point, now a Liberal Party candidate for the Canadian Parliament. Chrystia Freeland, welcome.
Great to be here.
Wonderful to have you right here. Martin Gillens is here, professor of politics at Princeton University, a big voice on inequality and public policy, author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America. Martin Gillens, thank you so much for coming. Great to have you here.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And with us, Harvard's own Alex Kasar, professor of history and social policy at the Kennedy School, an historian with an eye on the now, voting, democracy, poverty, and more, author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. Alex Kasar, welcome. Great to have you right here. All right, so in our warm-up this evening, and I'm so glad we're sitting here, I think this is an urgent issue. I'm glad we're talking about it. It's been talked about for a long time. Let me quote two. 1762, Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote in The Social Contract, "The democracy can only exist in a society in which no one is so rich as to be able to buy another, and no one is so poor so as to have to sell himself." And bring it right here to this country. Justice Louis Brandeis, famously, many of us familiar with this, said, "We can either have democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we cannot have both." Martin Gillens, are we getting close with everything we're hearing about inequality to the point at which we cannot have both?
I think we have reached to that point. Democracy is not a yes or no kind of characteristic. It's a continuum, and we have a degree of democracy that in regard to the responsiveness of public policy to the preferences of the public, a core feature of what it means to be democratic, that has declined over time as inequality has grown.
And because of this very rise we're seeing, this latest report that came out was 10% of Americans took more than half of the country's total income last year, 1% way up there, sort of up at historic highs as well, because of exactly that kind of number?
The concentration of wealth certainly encourages and abets the concentration of political power. So absolutely, these two things are intertwined. And as economic inequality has grown over the past three or four decades, political inequality has grown as well.
Alex Kasar, we did not have equality at the origin of this country. The founders never envisioned any kind of absolute equality. They were very familiar with all different stations in life, different levels of wealth. How did they think about this country and the distribution of wealth, inequality, and how it might influence the course of the nation's democracy?
Interestingly, Tom, the founding fathers also thought that extreme inequality, even though they recognized it in their society, was incompatible with democracy. Many of them responded to that by saying, then let's not have democracy. I mean, let's
okay.
No, I mean, let's remember, at the outset, basically, the franchise was extended to white men who owned property.
Yes.
or paid taxes.
Yes.
There was another current of thought, most vividly expressed by Jefferson, who said, you can't have a society that's democratic where some people own all the land and other people work on it. So let's give everybody some land. Mm-hmm. that was another
some
possible
skin in the game.
Right. And also then people would not be powerless and could not be unduly influenced by others. So I think that this problem has been recognized since the outset. But I also think that the problem has become extreme in terms of both the inequalities and the power wielded by economic power in the 20th century, that it's different in an agricultural society where most people, say, in the northern states owned farms and in a society like the modern United States.
So, Christia, how do we begin to judge as a society that's, especially in recent decades, very devoted to market forces, and in all of our history, really, but also in principle and in fact devoted to democracy, how do we judge when we're approaching or at a line that's just too much inequality? How do you know when to say, wait, time out, our democracy is being derailed by too much inequality? How do we discern that?
Well, a few ways to discern it might be that economic number that you just cited. I mean, when you start getting to the point, and I think what's really striking in the United States is the extent to which the recovery since 2008 has been a 1% recovery.
95% of the gains since the recovery began gone to the top 1%.
Even more on some measures. I mean, it
depends. How much more is there?
No, actually, I mean... I brought some data points myself.
Great.
And between 2009 and 2011, the 1% got 121% of the gains in income. And you may say, how could they get 121%?
These guys on Wall Street are geniuses.
It's because the 99% went down. They went down by 0.4%. Right? And what's really striking about that and why it is worth reflecting on is in 2008, a lot of people thought that income inequality had hit a high,
mm-hmm.
and that the financial crisis was, you know, the sort of the death
this
spasm
must be it.
Of
this
that
must be the
system,
peak. Yeah.
And that the system could not endure, that society would not permit it to keep on going, right? I personally thought that. I actually decided I couldn't write my book anymore because I thought the plutocracy was over. So I had a whole new, I wrote a new book proposal. It was something called like Survivors, and it was going to be who endured and adapted to the new system.
Mm-hmm.
But then it turned out that it actually kept on going. And this is really, really remarkable because the financial crisis in many ways was a product of the same economic forces that are creating this extreme income inequality. But instead of stopping in its tracks, it has continued. So I think that does say to you, it's gone too far. It is not sustainable. And I think you are seeing, I mean, Martin has done some wonderful work documenting
mm-hmm.
the way in which you do have a correlation between greater inequality and less voice for everybody. So we know that. That's not just an idea that we have. Read his research and he shows it. But I think the other thing is we're seeing it in lots of less direct ways that the political system is sort of having a seizure too. It's just not working. And I don't think you have to be a rocket scientist or even, you know, a Harvard or Princeton professor to think that these two things are connected.
Martin, how do we judge this? Gone too far, Christia says. But do we judge it in number terms? If 120% of the recovery has gone to the top 1%, my goodness, that's too much. Do we judge it in outcome terms? Do we have any real apparatus for judging it that matters that's related to back into process and procedure and the way our democracy is structured, or is this just live off in a kind of academic realm by itself? You know, oh, it's a fact, but there's no connective tissue that lets us address it.
Yeah, well, there are ways of addressing it. And let me first say, in response to Christia's excellent point about what we've seen since 2009, that, you know, the people at the top of the income distribution have recovered very nicely, both in terms of income, in terms of their wealth, and the people in the middle and at the bottom have not. Now, imagine if it was the reverse. would we see the kind of political response or lack of political response that we see today?
You mean if 95% of the people had had, you know, a great recovery and the top 1% had not?
If it was the people at the top that had not recovered.
In all honesty, these days that's hard for me even to picture.
Absolutely.
But I mean, really,
but
I'm stretching.
We would see a political response of the sort that we saw in 2007, 2008.
You mean, it would be a disaster, it would be an emergency, we would need intervention, save the banks.
Democrats and Republicans would come together as they did at that point. Huge amounts of government resources would be directed at the problem because it was a problem that affected the affluent.
So if we're not seeing that kind of intervention, Alex, is that the evidence that inequality has taken our democracy out of engagement with the people, the majority of the people?
Let me give a slightly sideways answer to that, because I think in the 20th century United States, we've sort of accepted the coexistence of two kinds of institutions, a set of economic institutions where there would be great inequality. But the notion was that the political system, democracy, is a counterweight to that. Mm-hmm. One person, one vote, everybody's vote counts. Yeah. Now, it seems to me that the danger of inequality and the point at which you recognize that inequality has gone too far is when those inequalities in the economic system are being replicated in the political system and the wealthy are able to force that replication onto electoral institutions.
We've got a lot on the table. We've got a lot to look at. We're talking about democracy and inequality, the first of a big series of investigations sponsored by the Ash Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Alex Kasar, Krista Freeland, Martin Gillens, please stand by. To our audience here, thank you for being here. We've got a lot of questions that have already come in on social media and from you in the hall. We will go to them just as soon as we return. This is a special edition of On Point, live from Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're in front of a live audience at the JFK Junior Forum at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and this is On Point. We are talking about democracy and inequality. We have plenty of inequality. Do we have enough democracy these days in the face of all that inequality? With me on a terrific panel here, Krista Freeland. She is a longtime journalist, now Liberal Party candidate for the Canadian Parliament. She's moved from the realm of looking at this, jumping right into it in Canada, author of Plutocrats. We'll ask her about them. Martin Gillens is with us, professor of politics at Princeton University, author of Affluence and Influence. Alex Kasar is here, professor of history and social policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, author of The Right to Vote. We've got inequality aplenty in this country. We know the numbers. They're very big. They're as big as they've been in a century and by some measures ever. But we also have one person, one vote. So isn't that supposed to be the antidote, Martin? And if it's not working, why not? I mean, you can have all the money you want, but the idea is you still just got one vote, so we're okay, right? Or not?
Elections work, but not as well as they need to. So the research in my book, Affluence and Influence, mm-hmm. looks at how government policymakers respond to what the preferences of the public are, what kinds of policies the public endorses. And what I found is that looking over a period of many decades from the 1960s on, that policy at the federal level reflects the preferences of affluent Americans, but not those of the middle class or the poor when those preferences diverge. Now, you asked about elections. That is a general trend that the richer you are, the more influence you have over government policy, but there's variation, and one of the things that influences that variation is elections. So I found that in years leading up to presidential elections, mm-hmm. that policy more closely reflects the preferences of the public and more equally reflects the preferences of low and high-income Americans.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's because the antenna are out, because the sensitivity is high, because the popular vote is very important in that year.
Politicians need money, but they need votes as well. Mm-hmm. That's right. And they respond to the public when they need to. And then when elections are over, we see policy reverting to much more closely following the preferences of the affluent and of the parties, irrespective of what any member of the public wants.
Is your research entirely up to date on that? I mean, after all, in the last electoral round, in the primary season, we saw, at least in one case, one very rich individual supporting one very prominent candidate who didn't end up doing very well. So, Newt Gingrich, but It was one pot of gold that was driving him through the political system. Does that change the kind of findings that you've discovered?
For the most part, no. I mean, it's true you can't necessarily buy elections, and plenty of people have tried and failed. Mm-hmm. And we saw that in many cases in the last few election cycles. Nevertheless, in order to be a viable candidate in the first place, you need money. And that money comes virtually exclusively from affluent individuals and interest groups. And so while the person with the most money may not win, the person with no money has no chance.
Alex, we're so deep into this at this point that I can well imagine Americans saying, you know, surely money has always bought influence in this country. What's new under the sun here?
And those persons would be largely right. I mean, the famous quote from Mark Hanna, the campaign manager of Theodore Roosevelt and creator of the modern Republican Party, who said that there's two important things in politics. The first is money, and I can't remember what the second is.
We're talking more than a century ago.
That's more than a century ago. I think part of what we're seeing at this particular moment is a fairly aggressive use on the part of some of the elites of this country to increase their own power beyond where it already is, for example, by changing the campaign finance laws and the restrictions which were supposed to regulate and minimize this, mm-hmm. and at the same time making it increasingly difficult for some segments of the working classes and the poor to actually cast their ballots with one person, one vote. Mm-hmm. I mean, the voter ID laws, which are my informed opinion, preposterous, and you know, cutting back on Sunday voting in some states. All of this is aimed at reducing the participation. Interestingly, the participation of people whose participation rates in the last 34 years is not that high anyway.
Is that driven by the wealthy? Is that some rich guy cackling in a room somewhere in front of a fire? They won't vote. I'll make it too hard. Is it really driven by...
Well, I don't think
wealth?
They cackle, but
are you sure?
But you know, for example, a lot of these voter ID laws are actually based on a template created by the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a conservative group and think tank that is in fact funded by wealthy conservatives,
okay.
and this outfit has written the draft law and sent it out to various states, and they have modified it for local purposes. So, you know, I don't want you to be too conspiratorial, but it's not an accident that these voter ID laws and similar laws have cropped up in 32 states simultaneously.
Christy, you've written the book, Plutocrats. I mean, you've hung out. You've been on the jets. You've, you know, been at the, I don't know, the polo matches.
No polo matches.
Okay, no polo matches. But, I mean, you've spent time. What's your sense of how those who are in the midst of this very concentrated wealth that we have now think about American politics these days? We know they're of all political stripes, but is there an allergy to full democratic exercise? Do you hear when you're in those halls of wealth, you know, let's rein this in. Let's be sure our lobbyists have control of this. Let's not have all those scruffy voters at the polls. They may not agree with our agenda. Is there that deliberate kind of view, or does the money just somehow emanate power in itself?
Well, one of the things that I found that was actually a real surprise for me and initially a disappointment for my publishers is that, you know, in that lifestyles of the rich and famous kind of way, super conspicuous consumption is actually less hip and trendy among the plutocrats than you might think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the really cool thing nowadays is not to have the biggest yacht.
The invisible
it
rich.
It is to have the most influential think tank.
Okay.
That's where the real action is. You want to have a think tank, a foundation with the very smartest, you know, ideally Harvard-trained scholars who are out there coming up with the best policies in line with your own values. So, yes, there is absolutely, mm-hmm. I think, an outsized and very deliberate effort by actually the very best of the plutocrats to transform their economic power into not necessarily directly political power, but policy power. And actually,
when
I think
you say the
it,
best
of,
do you mean the richest of, or do you mean the clearest thinkers? Do you
mean
the Koch
the
brothers? Do you mean Peter Thiel? Who are you talking about?
All of them.
Really?
And I mean, you know, the most engaged, the most energetic, and it's actually quite a complicated thing to think what your response should be. Mm-hmm. Because in general, what I find is when a plutocrat is using his energy and his billions to advance social policies that one personally agrees with, one calls that person a brilliant philanthropist. Mm-hmm. And when a plutocrat is using his billions to advance policies that one does not agree with, one calls that a person who is manipulating politics unfairly. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, you know, as you say, you know, you have the Koch brothers and you also have Bill Gates. Mm-hmm. You know, you have people on all sides of the political spectrum. What they have in common is there is this very conscious, very deliberate, not disguised, you know, quite proud move to say, okay, I have my billions. It's not enough to be one. One guy said to me, you know, it's not enough to be just another rich guy in New York. I want to do something in the world. And
so passé.
You know, it is. You know, there are lots of guys, rich guys in New York. And there is a real democracy deficit issue there because with billions in a foundation, you can influence policy without all that pesky work that you used to have to do to build community organizations. I mean, Theda Scotchpol here at Harvard has done some great work about how American community organizations have moved from being, you know, people paying a little bit every month and going door to door and talking to lots of people in the community to organizations funded by a rich guy with professional staffers who generally, you know, tend to be like a liberal elite and are very happy to not have to go door to door in, you know, the flyover state.
Martin Gillens, is it evident that however benevolent or the opposite, any particular wealthy person or concentration of wealth may be, that American policy has bent toward the interests of the affluent, the wealthy in this era, in this period?
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, if you think about sort of the landmark legislative changes that have occurred over the last few decades, things like, you know, the Bush tax cuts or NAFTA, the sort of free trade agreements that have been signed, deregulation across a variety of industries, of course, finance among them most prominently. These are all trends that have been supported by both political parties. So while it's true, yes, there are rich Democrats and there's rich Republicans, but they all tend to support these kinds of market-oriented, free trade, you know, deregulatory shifts, which have been massively beneficial to much of, not all, but much of the business community in the United States and to affluent members, affluent Americans, but not so much for the middle class and certainly not for the poor. So we've seen shifts across decades of both parties supporting policies that are favored by and beneficial to the affluent.
So let's start to bring in questions here from around the country and from students right here in the hall. This one from a student. Jenny asks, should a democratic society prioritize economic inequality as an issue to be addressed, given that there are indications that the American people are much more concerned about economic and job growth than they are about inequality? And this does tend to be a kind of American set point. Look, give me a job. Give us economic growth. Let us all in on the goodies. At what point do you have to turn and address inequality itself? And who decides that? Who adjudicates this?
I mean, these are tough questions. I think one of the things we have to recognize is that these are not separate issues, that inequality and growth are related in complicated ways that economists debate. But that we say we want growth, but it's not enough for that growth to occur only at the top of the income distribution. Mm-hmm. There has to be growth in the middle class and at the bottom. And we have not seen that over the last few decades. We've seen a lot of growth at the top, and we've seen the middle class stagnate in terms of real wages.
Me, that's the key point, right? If we were having this discussion 30 or 40 years ago, then I would have been very happy to say, fine, just push for growth and push for higher productivity, and you are going to see everybody benefit. And that's what you saw happening. But what has happened is the way the economy works, and this is not just a U.S. story, it's happened across the Western industrialized democracies, the way the economy works has changed. And really since, you know, people argue, was it since the late 70s, late 80s, late 90s, but there's been a decoupling of increases in productivity and increases in GDP and improved standard of living and wages for the middle class. And that, to me, is the real political, you know, the most urgent political and economic question. You've had growth across the Western industrialized democracies, but for the past 30 years, the middle class has been treading water. that to me is not sustainable, and certainly not sustainable when you have democracy.
Alex, I see you on this front.
Right, I'd like to jump in here, because it's also very important to note that there's a long period, a 30, 40-year period in American history, which economic historians refer to as the Great Compression, mm-hmm. from the 1940s into the 1970s, okay, when economic growth until the 70s was very high, and inequality was at the lowest points it has been in the last century.
And a lot of boomers, baby boomers, grew up thinking, this is what America is.
Absolutely.
This is what it means.
Right. No, absolutely right. So this notion of inequality or a definite tension between inequality and growth is mistaken. I mean, the growth came in part in the 50s and 60s from, in fact, increases in equality.
So let me ask you, here's a question or comment from Cody, one of our listeners on Facebook. It says, the top wealthy few can buy the attention of politicians to shape policy in their favor. The rest of us live with what the wealthy decide. Now, that's really boiling it down. But is there a point at which this is a crisis? And how do we decide? And how do we communicate that? And what, as a democracy that's had periods of compression of equality and periods of inequality, you know, what sort of brings out the fire department if it's a problem? How do we decide? Who rings the bell?
You do.
We just ask questions.
We don't know the answer. I mean, I think we've had a financial crisis. You know, we've had one, and that didn't seem to ring the bell loudly enough.
The public didn't say, holy smokes, enough already, enough with that. But, you know, where's our FDR?
Right.
They didn't say that.
And the electoral system worked as something of a counterweight, electing Obama, you know, as president. There isn't an indicator that we can point to and say when things get to this number that, you know, then we're in crisis. I think that that will be determined by when enough people mobilize themselves and organize themselves and really just say we've had enough. I mean, to my mind, it will be and is being accelerated by the inability of a lot of people to use conventional democratic means in order to combat this excessive influence.
Martin Gillins, what would you say? I mean, you have the ear of the country as well as the hall. Is our democracy in a crisis because of the level, the historic level of inequality that we have found ourselves at? Is it? And if so, you know, what are the indicators that you would lay out to a populace to say, heads up, it's time for something to be done?
Well, we are certainly in a crisis. I mean, we're recording this show while our federal government is shut down.
And there's been gunfire on Capitol Hill. These are not good reports.
But that aspect of the crisis is a function of many things and not just of inequality. You know, I think Alex is right that it's a gradual thing, and it's, you know, there's this metaphor of the frog in the water, and it gets hotter and hotter.
Mm-hmm.
And
boil the frog.
I've heard this isn't really true,
but for the frog's sake,
I hope it's not. At any rate, you know, there's a little bit of a feeling like that. It's like, when will it be enough? When will, you know, people reach that point? And I do think that the notion that you're the one to ring the bell, that there's some truth in that. It's that the media and political elites of all stripes, not just talking about politicians in Washington, you know, it will take that kind of leadership to bring together the, I think, widespread dissatisfaction that exists into and mobilize it politically. And without that kind of leadership, simply having widespread dissatisfaction will not bring change.
Christian, we just got a minute before the break, but do you think the shutdown is a manifestation of this problem, this issue somehow, the government shutdown right now, or is that just an ideological battle that's not to do with inequality?
I think it's definitely connected. I think the extreme polarization you're seeing in U.S. politics, I think especially, you know, on the right, that extreme Tea Party populism, that's exactly what you've seen, and you've seen it in other societies.
But a lot of those Tea Party people are by no means billionaires.
Of course not. I mean, you do see right-wing extremism as one response to an economically polarized society. That's one direction people can go and one direction in which people can be pushed.
What? I've got questions right there. I've got plenty about why inequality might bring out right-wing extremism, whether it might bring out the opposite. We've seen a candidate for mayor in New York who's talking about a tale of two cities. This is a kind of message of wealth and poverty, or inequality in any case, that we have not heard at the forefront in American politics in a long time. Now it's there in New York. We'll look at that and much more. We're recording, or in the midst of, a special edition of On Point for a live audience at the Kennedy School of Government in Cambridge, Massachusetts tonight. Chrystia Freeland, Martin Gillens, Alex Kesar, it's great to have all of you with us right here. And to the audience in the hall, we'll come to more of your questions after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We are in front of a live audience at the JFK Junior Forum at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We're talking about democracy and inequality, and this is On Point. We have a great inquisitive audience here and a great panel. Chrystia Freeland, author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super-Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. Martin Gillens, of Princeton University, author of Affluence and Influence. Alex Kesar of Harvard, author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States. And we are looking at democracy and inequality, the challenge of the new extremes, at least by American historic standards that we're at right now. And if you look at a map of the world on equality by global standards, we are pinning the needle in this country lately. What does that mean for our democracy? Questions. Here's Jack in San Diego, and here's his question. Chrystia, I'll put it to you. Inequality of wealth is necessary for wealth creation. Big projects need lots of capital, right, Chrystia? You've written for the Financial Times. We need this for capitalism to boom.
Well, as Alex has pointed out, we've actually lived through in the world a lot of periods, and in fact, in particular, that post-war era that I think shaped how a lot of us in North America and Western Europe think about how market democracies work. What's really interesting about that time is you had unprecedented growth in this huge swath of the world, and you actually had inequality decreasing. You actually had, believe it or not, falling salaries for CEOs. Really, it happened.
What was that phrase? I didn't quite
catch
that phrase.
No. They were actually declining relative to the wages paid to their workers. Think about that. Our brains can't even comprehend that anymore. And that also happened to be a period, probably not by accident, that you had huge capital projects undertaken. Absolutely enormous, both by the private sector and by the public sector. So no, I don't think that you need to have huge wealth concentrated in the hands of a few billionaires in order to have capitalism work. In fact, right now, I'm worried about the opposite. You know, I think that, you know, in the Western world, there's a real risk of getting to the point where if consumers are too squeezed, they are not going to have the spending power to keep the economy going. And, you know, one popular explanation of, well, not popular, a smart explanation of why the credit bubble happened was that that was a way that the sort of political economy worked to mask stagnating incomes. And you had both Democrats and Republicans not wanting to make a big political shift, but saying, oh, okay, let's pump some consumer credit towards the middle class. They'll feel good. They'll spend money. The economy will be booming.
Mm-hmm. A couple of observations from our listeners. Nick writes, inequality is so intertwined with our democracy, it's hard to tell the difference. And then it's been that way since the founding. I imagine it will continue that way. There's a kind of instinct among Americans not to protest inequality too much, at least lately. You'll tell us about history. And then Ogden goes way back. Ogden says, according to Aristotle, one either limits inequality or one limits democracy. Ogden writes, Aristotle proposed limiting inequality. Madison, J. et al. Proposed limiting democracy, a limited democracy, one of unequal shares in the society, is the root of our problems. We'll see if anyone can deny their own privileges to admit the truth. We don't have a perfect version of either. We don't have perfect inequality or equality. We don't have perfect democracy. But how do we begin, if our history is any guide, to recognize a moment like this and turn back toward some more sustainable equilibrium, Alex?
Well, I think that part of what we do is to recognize what has worked at some moments in the past. I mean, including, we've alluded several times to this period of the 40s, 50s, 60s, and it was a period when part of what was going on was that state policies, the political system, a democratic political system, was producing state policies that were protecting the less privileged members of the society. And I think we can look back at that period, because in addition to getting growth and narrowing of inequality, this was also the period when we got Social Security, Medicare, and a number of other things which were basically protective of the masses of people. I think that the tension between inequality and democracy is there. It isn't going to go away. I mean, part of what we're talking about is how much is too much, and how do we protect the inequalities within the economic system from destroying the political system.
But think about triggers in the past, the 40s, 50s, 60s that had this great equality that's so famous, the sort of golden age of American equality. Didn't those policies grow out of first the progressive era and then the New Deal? Those were the trigger moments when the American polity responded to concentration of wealth. Take us back to how those moments were recognized at the time. I mean, we know the New Deal came out of that huge slap across the face and worse of the Great Depression. What about the progressive movement? What was the popular trigger for that great movement?
It's interesting. There in New York State, at least, and this was somewhat national, there actually is a moment in 1905, and historians and political scientists have written that this was the moment when they discovered that business really does corrupt politics. Now, it wasn't the first time it had happened. I mean, you know, the use of the word railroad as a verb to railroad something comes in the 1870s and the 1880s, referring to the power of railroad corporations.
Railroad money.
Right, railroad. But I think the trigger is a combination of recurrent depressions and this recognition that corporate money, unless stopped, and the money of the wealth will really profoundly corrupt our politics, and that leads to some changes. That leads to pressure to have the direct election of senators, for example, rather than to have senators chosen by state legislatures. And it leads to a banning of corporate money in politics, a ban which remained in place until quite recently.
But we have the sense today, Martin Gillens, that there's a kind of muted quality to this sort of public discourse because the power of money influence in politics is so large that it steps on these ideas, on these thoughts, on these impulses, and they don't mount.
I think that's true, and I think part of it has to do with what we were talking about earlier in terms of like who will provide the leadership, who will provide the organizational impetus to shift from simply a sort of broad dissatisfaction into something mobilized. And unions have traditionally played that role in this country, as in most Western countries.
What do they represent now? 7% of American workers?
So absolutely.
6%, something down there? I mean, that's pretty small. Are they in a position to do that now?
I think they're not. And I think that's part of why we don't see the same kinds of responses today that we might have seen in an earlier era under similar conditions.
Well, Christian, where are the governing influences here? I mean, for a long time, it was maybe the Cold War. I mean, even the people at the top felt like we had to have a showcase democracy, economy of some kind that we could brag on to the world and say this is the way to go. That pressure is off, or maybe it's not. Here's China with an alternate view saying, I mean, they're going to be at this big Asian conference where I guess President Obama will not. Will they not be sort of pointing across the Pacific to the United States in all of its disarray and saying, you want to go down that democratic road? Is there pressure from that dynamic now or not?
Well, I think that's an excellent point. And actually, I had written down here as Alex was talking Bolshevik Revolution, because I think that's something that we tend to forget when we think about what actually, with hindsight, was this really magnificent response of Western capitalism to all the strains and inequalities of the Industrial Revolution. Like, when you think back, that was the previous real peak of inequality. Mm-hmm. The rich guys had a huge amount of power. We didn't yet have the idea of mass democracy. And actually, they decided to share. And they decided to share in, most of the Western industrialized world, in Canada, in the United States, in Western Europe, build up these great social institutions, actually allow inequality to shrink. And it's sort of amazing that sort of generosity and long-sightedness. When you read some of the debates from the 20s and 30s, part of what was going on was looking east and seeing what had happened to their brethren in Russia who had not chosen to share. Mm-hmm. And that was total confiscation and actual, real full-blood, fully-fledged communism. And so I think that, existence of an alternative that really scared the capitalist class and also offered to people who were radical on the left an idea that there was a different way you could live was quite energizing. Something that I think is difficult for everybody today is, sure, Beijing and Shanghai right now might be laughing at the United States and saying, your democracy doesn't really
work. Shut down,
But I don't think that there are too many people in the United States who think, gee, I really want to be governed in the way the Chinese are governed. Gee, that's a really effective,
wonderful, give us some of that. Mm-hmm.
Appealing way to live. And that's a difference. There was a time when a lot of people felt, if not fully blown communism, certainly socialism was a real and effective way to run an economy. I think part of our problem is we sort of see that inequality is rising. We see that that's a huge problem. We see the middle class is stagnating. But I think we don't yet have a clear set of economic solutions. How do you stop? You don't want to stop the technology revolution. You don't want to stop globalization.
Which produces a lot of fortunes.
You don't want to stop globalization. And they don't just produce fortunes. They're hollowing out the middle class. And yet, they're basically good. So how do you rein these things in?
But you don't want to rein in technological advancement.
Right.
How do you have a decent economy if you do? I mean, Martin, I don't even see countervailing pressures globally. Globalization has created, in part, we're told, has created inequality in many countries. China's got plenty of inequality. Even Europe and even the Scandinavian countries, inequality has grown in recent years.
Even Canada.
Though Europe's social mobility at this point still higher than ours. I don't know about Canada's compared
ours
to yours.
Ours is higher than yours,
Canada's
yes.
Higher. Oh, everybody's higher than ours. We just can't stand it. But it's true. But does that take the pressure off the American concentrations of wealth to look around and say we have to do better if there's concentration everywhere? Is this just a global situation now?
Well, I think we have to recognize both the global forces that are impacting all of these societies and pushing things in a more unequal direction, and that different societies have responded very differently to those forces. Right. So in Western Europe, over the last 30 years, this period of considerable globalization, policies have shifted in a way to minimize the resulting inequalities, whereas in the United States, our social policies have gone in the opposite direction, with less progressive taxes and so on, so that we've ended up not just not fighting against these sort of global forces, but actually accelerating their impact. And so, we have to recognize that there's both sides to that coin, and that we do have choices, and that the political systems are important in shaping the kinds of policies that are adopted and, therefore, the impact on people's lives.
Let's imagine an alternative universe where these things are not being driven further, but rather we had leadership in Washington that said, for the health of our democracy, our polity at large, we want to rein in the inequality a little bit. Yes, we'll still have plenty of rich people, but some of these extremes, let's bring them back. We don't want to crush the economy. We don't want to stop growth. What kind of policies, if there were politically possible, an open field, where we wanted to maintain a market system, economic growth, not opposed to plenty of inequality, just not so crazy extreme. What kind of policies might help rein that in, Alex?
Well, I think the traditional policies, I think you would raise taxes in a progressive way. The fact is also during this period of the Great Compression, the highest income tax rate in the United States was about 75%. Now, we couldn't get it all the way back to 75% now, but I think that you can have increases in taxes.
Ronald Reagan would say, wrong, drop them down, you're going to have more growth.
He would, right, and David Stock.
And he did. Deficits, too.
Right, exactly. I mean, you can have his own kind of Keynesianism, which did it. But you could increase government revenues in that way, and you could strengthen and build not only the traditional safety nets, but it seems to me, if one reads a number of analyses of what's going on in our labor force and the needs for people to have different kinds of education and training, that we really need a very, very large-scale set of programs to train and educate people for 21st century jobs. And there is no reason in the world. I mean, in fact, this was an idea put forward by Robert Reich when he was Secretary of Labor 20 years ago. This is not pie in the sky, and these are the kinds of things that are happening in Western Europe.
Martin, you know that there are plenty of Americans who say you build those safety nets too thick and deep and cushy, and they undermine social values, they undermine initiative, they actually end up undercutting economic growth.
There absolutely has always been, throughout our history, a concern about the sort of, you know, effects on incentives that these kinds of programs will have, that even private charity has. But the fact is that despite those concerns, most Americans think we need to be doing more to help the underprivileged.
I mean, we're looking at the gap in test scores between rich and poor children is now 30 to 40% wider than 25 years ago. But we need those children to be productive members of society. Something's off.
That's absolutely right. And I think if we talk about what kinds of social policy change we need, the most important policies are those that impact everything, which is to say campaign finance regulations. The role of money in politics is so important and so influential across the range of what other kinds of policies we can successfully adopt. That's where we need to focus a lot of attention.
Krisha, getting to those things, you know how hard it is in this country. Look at Washington right now. I mean, you can paint a scenario of, oh, yes, we'll think these thoughts, then we'll just go do these things and everybody will be happy. We could just as well end up at the Alamo. I mean, we're kind of at the Alamo right now. Do you see this country working this out, or do you see us wending our way deeper in here until we get in some sort of deeper fix in terms of the healthy exercise of democracy than we're in now?
Well, Tom, I am really an optimist, and I guess that is reflected in my decision to go out and try to do something in my home. Well, no, directly, right? And we're facing the same issues, and that's exactly my personal motivation. And I do think a council of despair is completely the wrong thing here. And I think also, sure, this is a huge problem. It's really complicated. It's really big. But we as human beings have dealt with huge problems before. Right? You know, our grandparents fought the Second World War. Pretty big problem. They did it. We've been talking now about the progressive era and the New Deal. In some ways, that was a bigger lift than what we're talking about now, because people were poorer and they didn't have the template of what a social, of what real mass democracy looked like. They were moving from rural to urban and they were inventing everything from scratch. So, yeah, I think that this is definitely doable. And one thing that I would say is we shouldn't think about, you know, that someone's going to ring a bell and say, okay, this is it. We've hit the point of no return. We have to do something differently. I think that everybody who thinks that this is a big issue, and if you don't think it's a big issue, then you're not awake, needs to really think about what can I do about it. I really think, you know, that sounds really simple, but there is, in fact, a democracy, and if people actually mobilize themselves, you are going to make a difference. We are going to make a difference.
That doesn't mean it'll be easy. Big heads up, we are at a historic moment. I think we've established that tonight, that alone, to focus on that, to think about that. Our thanks to the Ash Center here at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University for raising these issues of challenges to democracy tonight. My thanks to our guests, Krisha Freeland, Alex Kesar, and Martin Gillens for being with us, and to the whole audience and all of your questions from the hall and around the country. Thank you very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.